From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Mr. Lee's well-documented views are the voice of a man who exhibits an alarming allegiance to racial preferences and a disturbing disregard for the Constitution.
Some members of the Senate Judiciary Committee are continuing to block the will of the Senate by holding Bill Lee hostage to their anti-civil rights agenda.
The politics of a nomination, Bill Landley and affirmative action, then a conversation with Quentin Young, from protester outside the Democratic Convention to president of the American Public Health Association. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Iraq ordered all American arms inspectors today to leave the country immediately, escalating Iraq's crisis with the United Nations and heightening the possibility of a military confrontation. The order came a day after the UN Security Council, by a 15-0 vote, condemned Iraq, imposed a travel ban on Iraqi officials, and threatened of unspecified further measures if Iraq did not reverse its decision to kick out the American members of the UN weapons inspections teams. But the resolution does stop short of calling for military action if Iraq continues to defy the world body. A number of Security Council members have said they're opposed to the use of military force, like Sergei Lavrov, Russia's ambassador to the UN.
However, we are convinced that any complications that arise, including current complications, should be resolved exclusively by political means, strictly within the framework of the appropriate resolutions of the Security Council. Any other approaches, particularly actions involving force or threat of use of force, could wipe out all of our achievements in reaching a post-crisis settlement in the Persian Gulf and take us all a long way back from the goal that was becoming close, that is, the goal of eliminating the threat to peace and security in that region.
China has also said it's opposed to military force, and France has not committed either way. Seeking to avert a backlash against Republicans, Congress is relaxing two provisions in a 1996 law that threatened to uproot hundreds of thousands of immigrants living in the United States. Lawmakers have agreed in the waning days of this year's session to exempt thousands of refugees from civil wars in Central America from sweeping new deportation rules. As many as 150,000 Nicaraguans would receive an automatic permanent residency. The FBI has written to the families of victims of TWA Flight 800, saying it's closing its investigation because it's found absolutely no evidence that a criminal act, such as a bomb or a missile, brought the plane down off the coast of Long Island in July of 1996, killing all on board. A previously unknown group claimed responsibility for the killings of four Americans in Pakistan, threatening more attacks if a Pakistani gets the death penalty for the 1993 murders of two CIA workers. Even before today's unproven claim of responsibility, authorities had linked the shooting deaths of four Houston-based oil company workers and their driver to the U.S. conviction of Mir Imal Qazi of Pakistan. Gunmen ambushed the Americans on Wednesday as their car inched along in a traffic jam in Karachi, 2 days after a Virginia court found Qazi guilty in the 1993 shooting spree outside CIA headquarters. The House last night passed the Foreign Operations Bill, which includes a provision that says no U.S. weapons can be used by the Indonesian military in East Timor. The Senate will vote today. Meanwhile, Lynn Fredrickson, the U.S. woman Democracy Now! Reported yesterday had been arrested by the Indonesian military in East Timor, is being deported. She was arrested for, quote, journalistic activities, that is, taking notes and photographs at a vigil of students at the University of East Timor yesterday. They were protesting on the sixth anniversary of the Santa Cruz massacre, where U.S.-armed Indonesian soldiers gunned down more than 250 Timorese. Speaking of brutality, this news from Los Angeles. An advocate for police brutality victims was chosen as a special prosecutor to handle the involuntary manslaughter case against an FBI agent involved in the deadly standoff with a white separatist in Ruby Ridge, Idaho. Attorney Stephen Yagman took the oath of office Wednesday to serve as special deputy prosecutor assisting Boundary County, Idaho. FBI sharpshooter Lon Hariuchi is accused of criminal negligence for killing Vicky Weaver, the wife of white separatist Randy Weaver, with a single shot. Hariuchi, who testified in an earlier trial that he was aiming at Weaver, could face up to 10 years in prison if convicted under state law. He's asked for the case to be moved to federal court. Weaver was killed during the 11-day standoff at the remote mountain cabin that began after federal agents tried to arrest Weaver for failing to appear in court for charges of selling two illegally sawed-off shotguns. Democracy and the rule of law are under threat. This, according to Hong Kong's leading human rights group yesterday in its first meeting with Hong Kong's new chief executive. Paul Harris, chair of Human Rights Monitor, told Hong Kong leader Tung Chee Hwa that police used unnecessary violence against demonstrators during a recent meeting of the International Monetary Fund. Police also admitted they followed protesters for a time after a demonstration against visiting Chinese Premier Li Peng. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Bill Lan Li, President Clinton's nominee for the country's top civil rights enforcement posts, heads to Congress today, where the Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to vote on his candidacy. But Li faces a tough battle. Senator Orrin Hatch, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has declared Li's nomination dead. The Utah Republican says that Li's support of affirmative action rules him out of the job. The White House and civil rights groups, though, are trying to push through the nomination. Li is believed to have the support of 9 of the Judiciary Committee's 18 members, 8 Democrats and 1 Republican. If Li receives 10 votes when the committee convenes today, his nomination would advance to the full Senate for a vote. Li, who heads the Western Regional Office of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund in Los Angeles, drew Republican fire last month during his Senate confirmation hearing by saying California's anti-affirmative action Proposition 209 was unconstitutional. He also said he agreed with a 1995 Supreme Court decision in a Colorado case in which the justices restricted government affirmative action programs. On Tuesday, Veterans Day, civil rights groups gathered in New York City to support the nomination of Bill Lan Li. In just a minute, you'll hear the speech of Reverend Jesse Jackson. But first to Margaret Fung, the executive director of the Asian American Legal Defense and Educational Fund.
As Asian Americans, we are dismayed and angered by the conservative campaign to derail Bill Lee's nomination and by Senator Orrin Hatch's sudden turnaround and announcement that the nomination was dead. We don't accept this, and we are urging the Asian American community to unite behind Bill and to urge Republican senators to join New York's own Senator D'Amato in voting for Bill's confirmation. We are especially proud to support Bill because he is a native New Yorker. He is the son of Chinese immigrants whose mother actually lives just a few blocks away in Chinatown. And because Bill is a person who has devoted his entire life to fighting for social justice and equality for all. Bill was a staff attorney here at the Asian American Legal Defense Fund, actually in our old offices at 350 Broadway, in 1979 to 1980. And he helped us to build our organization in its early days and to serve the Asian American community through the law. He was a personal mentor to me when I worked as a law student intern at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in the 1970s. And he inspired me and scores of other law students of all races and ethnic backgrounds to make a commitment to public interest law. We support Billy's nomination not simply because he is Asian American or because he is from an immigrant background. We support him because he is an exceptionally qualified candidate for the nation's top civil rights law enforcement job. He has a proven track record of accomplishments that have won praise from supporters and opponents alike. Unfortunately, his nomination has taken on a symbolic significance, and Republicans are unfairly making him the scapegoat for their own ideological agendas to abolish affirmative action. In fact, Asian Americans do support affirmative action, and we resent being used as a wedge group by conservatives like Clint Bolick of the Institute of Justice, Susan Al Allen, and others who delight in pitting Asian Americans against other communities of color. According to a Los Angeles exit poll, 60% of Asian American voters opposed Proposition 209 in California and supported the retention of affirmative action. Bill Li, our group, other civil rights groups, community groups, women's groups, labor groups, the Clinton administration, we've all taken the same position. Bill's legal philosophy is well within the mainstream, and attempts to misrepresent his actions and statements by Speaker Gingrich and other Republicans have been misleading and dishonest. This top civil rights post in the Justice Department has been vacant for almost a year. And the Justice Department Civil Rights Division doesn't only deal with affirmative action policies. It deals with the enforcement of all federal anti-discrimination laws, from prosecuting hate crimes to defending the voting rights of language minority voters. And as you all know, Chinese American voters here in New York City have benefited from the Justice Department's actions in enforcing voting rights laws. And ironically, as Republican senators sabotaged Bill Lee's nomination in Washington, D.C., the Asian American community here and in other parts of the country have supported Republican candidates who take moderate positions and support fair immigration policies. Here in New York City, just last week, when we did an exit poll of 1,300 voters, 72% of Asian American voters supported Mayor Giuliani. The fact is, Asian American community has rejected Republicans who seek to restrict family immigration and who unfairly deny benefits, food stamps, and other survival needs for illegal immigrants. And that's why in 1996, over 70% of Asian American voters around the country supported President Clinton and soundly rejected the reactionary Republican anti-immigrant platform. Asian Americans will continue to participate in the political process, and we urge all members of the Senate to confirm Bill Lee this week. Our next speaker will be Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Let me express my thanks and my delight at having this opportunity to share with you on this occasion today and to read this statement and to be a part of this magnificent coalition. Today, Abraham Lincoln would be ashamed of the way his party has divided along racial lines with their surprise ambush of Bill Lan Lee. Bill was nominated by President Clinton to serve as Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. Orrin hatched a bad egg last week. He's going to leave his party with a reputation that's sullied, egg on the face of the party. Never has the party of Lincoln's stooped so low, nor strayed so far from abolitionist roots. Lincoln was too honest to participate in such racial wedge politics. Then again, it is doubtful that his party today would nominate Lincoln to run on the ticket. Today is Veterans Day. Today we remember those who served in times of war in order that this country might live in peace. Let us not forget Bill Lan Lee's father was one of those servicemen. He was a laundryman who came to America penniless, on only with his belief in the American dream. He faced racism, humiliation, and discrimination, but he persevered. Together with Bill's mother, who lives only a few minutes away from here, built a life for his family. That veteran's son also worked hard and played by the rules. He lived a life that conservative speechwriters are always saying is open to any American who works hard, studies, and keeps his eyes on the prize. Bill Lan Lee attended Yale University on a scholarship, graduated Phi Beta Kappa, magna cum laude. From there, he went to Columbia Law School, spent most of his 23-year career following in the footsteps of Justice Thurgood Marshall, the founder of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and Educational Fund. Even his biggest opponents in this fight admit that he is qualified for this job with no hint of misdeeds or character flaws. The right-wing vendetta against this good and decent man does not pass the smell test. Last year, the GOP succeeded in bringing the Hispanic community together in solid opposition to their mean-spirited agenda. This year, they've switched to targeting Asian Americans, placing undue blame on the Asian American community for the bipartisan campaign finance scandal and now vilifying Bill Lan Lee. It's bad politics to alienate the two fastest-growing communities in America. Worse than that, this right-wing ambush violates the moral center. Bill is the choice of the president, was re-elected last year against an opponent who opposed affirmative action. Both Senator Hatch and Senator Thurmond originally supported Bill Lee. Senator Hatch and Thurmond originally supported him. until Clint Bullock fired up his poison facts. His opponents accused him of being a radical and equal opportunity, but if so, he is joined by the voters of Houston, Texas, who just last week defended affirmative action with a surprisingly strong vote. There was a time when the spirit of Lincoln defined the GOP on racial issues, a time when the Republican Party was better than the Democratic Party on race. Let us not forget, however, this same party booed Colin Powell when he spoke in favor of affirmative action upon which his career in the military was built, the Republican National Convention in San Diego last year. It is this mean spirit which is motivating the attacks on Bill Lee. We've gathered today to say that Bill Lee deserves a vote by the full Senate. Let us not forget that the Judiciary Committee sent the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the floor without recommendation, so the full Senate could consider this case. Let us not forget that the last Senate was controlled by Democrats, but they allowed Clarence Thomas a vote, despite serious allegations. Let us not forget that Clarence Thomas won that vote, strongly supported by the same senators now attacking Bill Lee, and is now a Supreme Court Justice for life. Bill is nominated to be an Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, not for life, but for 3 years, despite qualifications that are far superior to those of Clarence Thomas. Those who attacked Dr. King, who did not march beside him when he was alive, who argued that he was too radical, they stood on the wrong side of history. Now the same forces are compounding their mistake by going all out to kill Dr. King's dream by any means necessary. We stand together today in broad coalition to support Bill Lee, a superbly qualified advocate for civil rights. We stand together today to ask just one of those 9 Republican senators to join Senator Specter and the Democrats on the committee to send this vote to the floor. Remind each of them they will have to have the right to vote against him on the floor, but they should do the right thing, the decent thing, and agree to vote to send this nomination to the floor. The Republican elephant cannot pass the smell test with this ambush. Senators, this vendetta is dividing America. Give this man a chance. But he deserves the opportunity to help bring us together in the one big tent America for which Dr. King gave his life less than 30 years ago. This affirmative action remedy is not a minority issue. It's majorities, women and people of color. These poisonous terms, quotas, reverse discrimination, and preference, are not legal terms. They have no place in this debate. These new Republican extremists have the impact of enforcing states' rights and radically resegregating our country and denying opportunity. This is a moment for action. I urge those who are here today and allies around the nation, meet us Thursday morning at 9 a.m. at the Senate hearings. From around the nation, catch your plane, drive your car, be in great numbers Thursday a.m. in Washington. This is a defining moment. Indifference to the legitimate pain of Asian Americans is, in fact, a racist act. The legitimate aspirations of Asian Americans to be a part of this process must be honored. In Bill Land Lee, this man has the qualifications and no character flaw. He deserves, in fact, to serve the office for which he has been nominated. Thank you very much.
And that was the Reverend Jesse Jackson, along with Margaret Fung, the executive director of the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, speaking just 2 days ago in New York City. Of course, they're talking about this morning in Washington, D.C., when the Senate Judiciary Committee is slated to vote on the nomination for Bill Land Lee to be Assistant Attorney General on head of the Division of Civil Rights. The controversy continues on the floor of the Senate as one senator after another speaks about Bill Land Lee. This was Senator Mitch McConnell, followed by Senator Ted Kennedy.
Mr. Lee's well-documented views are the voice of a man who exhibits an alarming allegiance to racial preferences and a disturbing disregard for the Constitution.
Some members of the Senate Judiciary Committee are continuing to block the will of the Senate by holding Bill Lee hostage to their anti-civil rights agenda.
And that was Senator Ted Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts, along with Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky. In just a minute, we're going to speak with a woman who was represented by Bill Landley in a Texaco discrimination case. And then a conversation with Quentin Young. Today becomes the president of the American Public Health Association. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez of the New York Daily News and also In These Times. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy.
Well, in a little while, I'm going to talk about some latest developments going on in Brazil with the stock market and also the Dominican Republic, the major strike that took place just 2 days ago where a person was killed. But right now, we're going to continue on the issue of the nomination of Bill Landley, President Clinton's nominee for the country's top civil rights enforcement post. This nomination heads to Congress today, where the Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to vote on his candidacy. In fact, when some stations air this program, the decision may already be made. But right now, we're joined in our Washington studio by Irma Bernard. She is a former client of Bill Landley's. He represented her in a Texaco discrimination case. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Irma Bernard.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, why don't you tell us about this case? When did you bring suit against Texaco?
Okay, this started in 1989 while I was working at Texaco. I've been there for 10 years.
Where?
In Los Angeles, California. And I was hired at Texaco with the promise of an advancement. And I was working there, and 10 years later, I was still in the same position. Males who had come in after me with less qualifications were promoted, and I voiced my complaint, and it went on, you know, dying ears. So at that time, I approached Bill and his group about representing me, and he took my case.
And what was your experience with him as an attorney representing you during this time?
Oh, you know, at first, when I approached Bill, I was saying, oh, you know, he was such a nice person. You know, most of the time you talk to attorneys and all, but he was such a nice, caring person who was really interested in me and my well-being. He was interested in me staying on the job, doing well, getting what I wanted, but also being able to grow within the company. So this is how he started out representing me, you know, for as a whole person, not just for monetary, you know, relief.
And what happened with the case eventually?
Well, he was able to negotiate through compromise and on both sides, a way for me to be promoted on merit, not just by gender, and which happened. And after that, I continue to work for Texaco. I'm still employee of Texaco today. And since then, the company's gone on to promote other women to higher positions in the company. This was as a result of Bill's diligent negotiations.
Now, Irma Bernard, you're in Washington today. You're from Los Angeles. Why did you fly across the country?
Well, I just couldn't let this go without me speaking up because, you know, there are people out there who have just the political side of it. They don't get it from the human interest side. I was a person who was personally involved in some of Bill Lee's cases. And this man treated me with such dignity and respect and left such a overwhelming respect with me as to how he handled my case, how I was able to go back into the workplace. And I think this is what people need to know, is that people are looking at how he advocate for downtrodden. That's true, but he's not trying to stick it to the corporations. He just wants what's right for people on both sides. And that's the way, you know, he represents him. He want to go by the law. All the time he kept saying, this is the law. If they go by the law, you should have these rights. And that's all he was for. You know, I've heard them say on at the hearings, well, will you follow the law? Well, they have a man who will follow the law regardless of what it is, and that's Bill Lee.
And when you hear his track record being characterized as someone who is violating the Constitution, not respecting the Constitution, promoting preferences and quotas, what's your reaction?
Oh, I just can't believe that. I don't think that has nothing. I don't think in no way should they say that, because I think that's, if you listen to what Bill's saying, he's not talking about personal preference. He's just talking about people who are qualified, having a equal platform. That's what I believe he's saying. So I just, this other thing, I think it's just a fuel fire to the people who are ignorant enough to not understand what affirmative action really is.
You know, on the issue of the Texaco case, people certainly know about the latest Texaco discrimination case, where one of the top officials actually secretly recorded conversations between other Texaco top officials referring to African Americans with racial epithets and other sundry things. But I don't think people realize the history of Texaco, that this wasn't just an isolated incident. What was your take on this latest discrimination case?
Well, you know, I know people had their issues, and I really have to say, where I work at, I was treated fairly. And it's going to make sound kind of funny. But I think with Bill Lee, when he represented me, he was so forceful in negotiating things for some of the blacks in Los Angeles that I think Texaco had a more humanistic culture for me. I mean, that's my personal viewpoint from it. I was able to go back to work. You know, that's very rare for a person who sued a corporation to go back to work and continue to work in that environment. And I have since been promoted on merit, and I know it's on merit.
Let me ask you one other question, and that's about race. One of the things that people are talking about is the fact that if Bill Landley were to become head of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, he would be the first Asian American to lead this Justice Department division. You're an African American. There have been, as with many different communities, rifts in different communities. What are your thoughts on Bill Landley?
I'll trust Bill Landley with my life. You know, he's that type of man. You know, when I'm talking to Bill, there is, as Dr. King said, this is the person who makes you see there is no color barrier. And that's the way I feel toward him and the way he has treated me and my family. So, and with the way he has treated me, it has opened my eyes to all other ethnic groups like myself to just judge a person upon their character and not on their race.
Well, Irma Bernard, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Where do you head after this conversation?
Well, I'm going back to the office and pray for a miracle to move the senators in the way of to nominate confirmed Bill. And I hope that everybody else, you know, send a prayer out for Bill this morning. It's not that he needs the prayer. It's the people who are going to make the decision. They need the prayer to do the right thing.
Well, thanks very much for being with us, Irma Bernard.
Thank you. Thank
Again,
you.
Irma Bernard, a client of Bill Landley in a former Texaco discrimination case back in 1989. Irma Bernard from Los Angeles headed to Washington to support Bill Landley's nomination to be head of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, before we're joined by Quentin Young, the new head of the American Public Health Association, who is being sworn in today in Indianapolis, there are a couple things in the news that I wanted to get a chance to talk with you about. First of all, this big strike in the Dominican Republic. What's this all about?
Yeah, there was a two-day general strike that ended yesterday. by various trade unions, not the principled unions within the country, but many independent unions, because there's been an increasing crisis in the Dominican Republic under this the new president, Leonel Fernandez, because especially there's a huge electrical problem, which has been it's been historical in the Dominican Republic, that the electrical service is constantly going out throughout the country or in the capital city. But in recent, in the last year or so, it's gotten to critical levels where sometimes areas of the country go for days without electricity, and it's affected the economy. Businesses, a lot of businesses can't run. Consumers have problems in terms of buying in stores. And that coupled with the increasing unemployment. I think the unemployment in the Dominican Republic is over 30%, has created a general malaise in the country, so that these strikes against the presidency, actually, the way that the president is handling the crisis, led to mass protests. At least one person was killed, several injured by the police. And this is after several months ago, other strikes that where many more people were killed. So you've got a very, very difficult situation in the Dominican Republic right now. Increasingly, more and more Dominicans are coming to the United States. In fact, there was just a big report how Dominicans are now the poorest immigrant group in New York City. The number's over 500,000, but also throughout the rest of the East Coast. So it's a continuing problem that is not being addressed by this government. And remember, this was the president that replaced Balaguer, the longtime strongman of the Dominican Republic. So there was a lot of hopes on many people's part that things would change.
Well, Juan, when you and I covered Haiti, one of the major issues there, too, was where is the economy going to go? What direction is the government going to go when it comes to privatization in particular? You had the telephone company workers, the electrical workers, people extremely angry at the possibility of privatization of their companies. I mean, it's an issue of structural adjustment that is being pushed all over the world by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund.
Right. And one of the things that Fernandez is vowing to do is to privatize the government-owned phone company, that would make it more efficient. But I think that the reality is that that the problems in the Dominican Republic are structural in many ways, and that the country's been turned into an export platform for industries exporting to the United States in these free trade zones, as it happened much of the Caribbean and Latin America.
Talking about free trade zones, we have to talk about the big defeat for President Clinton this week, and that is the whole issue of fast track. I mean, they were working down to the wire. And that certainly connects to these issues and the kind of protests that are taking place around the country, around the world.
Oh, no, it was a huge, huge defeat, not just for the Clinton administration, but especially for Wall Street, because it was those Democrats and Republicans who danced to the tune of Wall Street, who were the main ones pressing free trade. It's amazing who were pressing fast track, excuse me, the latest version of the free trade movement. And I think that it's amazing that all of the postmortems that you've seen in most of the mainstream media talk about the fact that the Democrats under Dick Gephardt were running counter to the mainstream thought, when every single poll, including one conducted by the Wall Street Journal, shows that the overwhelming majority of Americans are against this fast-track legislation, the son of NAFTA, as we call it in the Daily News, the son of NAFTA fast-track, that all the polls indicate that Americans are sick and tired of their jobs being lost overseas under the guise of free trade. In fact, I don't know if you saw deep in the pages of the New York Times business section today, there was a mention that the chief executive of Levi Strauss, which just announced that it was going to have thousands of layoffs in its U.S. Facilities, earned $126 million last year from the company, over $105 million in stock options and $21 million in salary. So a company that just announced it was laying off about, I think it's 8,000 or 8,500 workers, Levi Strauss, paid its chief executive $126 million last year.
You also have a editorial in the New York Times today, Fast Track Falsities. And it says the refusal of House Democrats to give the leader of their party fast track authority to negotiate trade pacts is disturbing testimony to the power of organized labor's campaign money.
Yes. Now, the refusal of the Republicans and the Democrats to listen to the American people is not mentioned in this. But yes, the Democrats are being knocked all over the place.
Right, by American labor. I mean, it's very interesting when you look at how the Times puts it. I mean, what is behind Fast Track and what is the money behind pressing for opening markets all over the world? Of course, it's huge multinational corporations that benefit the most. But here we're talking about the big problem. The whole problem in the entire discussion is organized labor.
And it's amazing because this is the same organized labor that a few years ago had been declared dead by every major pundit, so-called economic expert. Every time you ask them about labor, oh, labor, that's passé. That's something that's unions are in the dustbin of history. So apparently there's been quite a change in perception by some of the people in Washington of late.
And let's not forget that the New York Times is also the newspaper that set up right before the NAFTA vote a whole section of NAFTA ads. I don't know if you remember this, pro-NAFTA ads, and they solicited ads from corporations. And then one organization, I can't remember if it was a labor union or a public interest group, said they also wanted to put in an ad, but against NAFTA. And they said they wouldn't be allowed to put that ad in that section. So they actually set up a pro-NAFTA ad section in the paper.
Yes. One other thing I'd like to mention, which I don't think in the has been getting a whole lot of attention, is the continuing crisis in Brazil. The stock market in Brazil lost 10% yesterday. This is, I think, the second 10% drop in the last few days. The Brazilian stock market is in total free fall. Now, you would say, well, how does that affect us? Well, Brazil is one of the largest countries in the world. It has also been, throughout this year, the darling of the world investment community. Before the crisis in Brazil started in July and August, the stock market was up 81% for the year. It was the hottest investment place for American investors and speculators. And now it is in total free fall. And despite the fact that Monday morning the Brazilian government announced a $19 billion austerity program that included laying off 33,000 government employees, raising the personal income tax in the whole country by 10%, increasing interest rates by 40 to 43%. Imagine 43% interest rates to the banks. Imagine what the interest rates for credit card holders are in Brazil right now. And despite this incredible austerity package devised overnight to stop the free fall, the market has continued to drop. And right now, if you read the back pages of the Wall Street Journal, the back business pages of the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, you're seeing people saying that the world financial system is on the verge of a major catastrophe unless something is done for what's happening in places like South Korea, Brazil, and other economic giants that we don't hear much about in this country.
Well, we were just talking about the strike in the Dominican Republic. Brazil also is going to speed up its program to sell off government companies and properties, from energy and phone companies to interstate highways.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. The privatization continues at breakneck speed.
At the same time today, Alan Greenspan is headed back to Congress. He'll be in the spotlight again. He's being called to testify before the House Banking Committee on the currency turmoil in Southeast Asia. Now, yesterday we had on our show Massachusetts Congressmember Barney Frank, and they have called both Alan Greenspan and Lawrence Summers, who's the Deputy Treasury Secretary, to testify today because, among other things, they're extremely angry that the United States, President Clinton in particular, has pledged this $3 billion backup for the loan guarantees to Indonesia without any strings attached, like issues like labor rights and human rights. And they're backing up a $30 billion loan from the IMF pushed by the U.S.
Wait till they see the bailout they're going to need for South Korea.
So we'll see what happens. You expect to see Wall Street go down again?
Well, no, I think, as I said a couple of weeks ago, I'm not a financial expert, but I follow these things very closely. And I think that 554-point drop was the crash, and it is going to, the stock market is going to continue to hemorrhage for quite a while.
Well, Juan, I also want to say I'm looking forward to Monday night, which is when Juan Gonzalez is going to be recognized by the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Social Justice for his lifetime achievement in journalism, though your lifetime is far from over, Juan. You must get nervous now getting all these lifetime awards.
No, somebody must be telling me something.
But Juan is being honored along with Harry Belafonte and Marlo Thomas and Phil Donahue. So I really look forward to that, and we'll bring our listeners news of that on Tuesday. Then we head out to San Francisco, and we'll be broadcasting from Pacifica radio station KPFA for the rest of the week. But right now, we're going to go to a break, and then when we come back, we'll be speaking to the new president of the American Public Health Association. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The American Public Health Association holds its 125th annual meeting in Chicago this week, with many of the group's key concerns, from environmental and children's health to disease control and food safety, facing serious challenges. In fact, the very notion of a public health is under attack in this age of privatization and globalization. We're joined now by Dr. Quentin Young, incoming president of the American Public Health Association. He's a clinical professor of preventive medicine at the University of Illinois Medical School and the National Coordinator of Physicians for a National Health Program. For 10 years, he was the chair of medicine at Cook County Hospital. And we welcome you just before your acceptance speech today to Democracy Now!, Dr. Young.
Yes, and good to be with you again, Amy. It was just a year ago when I first got president-elect in my name, and now a year later, in another 20 minutes, I will be inducted. So for a very serious year, I am very excited about the challenge and the opportunity.
Well, can you give us an idea about what you're going to be saying in your acceptance speech, what your plans are, what you think the major issues that have to be attacked in this country are around the issue of public health?
I certainly will, and I can also put it in terms of the organization, which I hope will be of interest to some of your listeners, and also about the issues. We also make our policy decisions here, and there were really very important ones. One, we have a very clear-eyed statement against the growth of greed and corporate takeover of the American health system. It's a brilliant statement, which I think will be a starting point for very important activity throughout the health profession and, indeed, the nation. We also made a heroic stand, I think, against the criminalization of welfare. We think that as public health workers, we see the folly of arbitrarily cutting people with the greatest need off without the beginnings of support in health, not to mention daycare and job training and all the rest. These issues are enormously important, and we have for the longest time supported a national health care system, universal health care, financed by a single government entity, so-called single payer, whether you use that term or not, we would like to have what the rest of the world have instead of an ever-worsening situation as corporate takeover creates more and more people without health care coverage. We are now up to about 43 million and rising. This is, we think, unacceptable. Another powerful stand was on this central issue of tobacco, which has been the news. The settlement that's been offered for all the billions in it is, we think, is fool's gold that will not address the real issue of ending tobacco consumption or giving redress to the people who have suffered and are losing their lives at the rate of 400,000 people every year. We took a very progressive stand on that issue, which will, I think, serve the American people. Finally, I am going to make a plea for restoring ethics in the health system and call on the APHA to take the leadership. It's the effect of profit-seeking arrangements has been to undermine the ethic. And by ethics, I mean the primacy of the patient, the idea that the patient's interest and the public's interest are always superior to any other. And the public health discipline, Amy, has that tradition. We are, I can say without any hesitation, historically altruistic, caring, concerned about whole populations. We are the perfect organization to lead this effort.
Well, Dr. Young, I'd like to ask you, a few years ago, when President Clinton was trying to get through his health, national health insurance plan, he was attacked on all sides by the corporations and insurance companies specifically because he was attempting to limit choice. After the defeat of his plan, all the big insurance companies did precisely what they were claiming President Clinton was trying to do. They all grabbed a hold of all of these managed care plans, and now they have successfully limited choice in health care for many Americans. What's your view of the spread of these HMOs? You hear all these horror stories about HMOs not allowing certain treatments or doctors now who are so fed up, they're unionizing to try to fight these managed care plans. What's your assessment of this revolution or counter-revolution that's going on in healthcare right now?
Well, we take the harshest view. You're absolutely right about the disinformation. You know, $200 million was spent on those Harry Louise ads and other forms of disinforming the American public. And you put your finger right on the irony. All the things they said would happen under Clinton's, which was really a plan that was soppy. We, for one, felt it fell far short of what we needed. But even attacking that successfully, they were predicting things that would happen under his plan, as you point out, that have come back in more intense form here. Loss of choice, limited access to specialists, reduced services, and ever more people without insurance. We are getting to a crisis level because we are not on the cheap. We're spending $1,000 billion on health care. That's a sixth of our whole gross domestic product. The American want and expect more and better. The trick is to get them to understand that they have been hornswoggled and that they have to, I was going to say boondoggled, and I didn't mean that. But in all seriousness, they have to come to understand that they can have what the rest of the world has, and that's part of our commitment, but it's gets back to this ethical issue as well as the service issue. I wanted to point out another decision that we have made that may be of interest to your listeners. We feel the need as a professional organization to enjoy the support and strength of the, I would say, millions of citizens who support the public health enterprise. Who among us do not want safe water, clean air, food that's been properly inspected?
Should we start ticking off the names now?
Yeah, I think about three people. And we, for the first time, are going to do more than just speak to these people and ask them to support a given crisis, but become, in a way, part of the organization. We're trying to conceive of a membership status, so-called public health citizen or public health advocate for the millions of people who are concerned about these issues, maybe have encountered problems in their local situation with them. You know, it isn't that long ago that we recalled 20 million pounds of beef that could have entered the food chain for millions of us, and every day brings a new problem of an infectious outbreak. So we're not safe. This is a constant battle. And if I may, I would like to give numbers where people could express their interest in this kind of arrangement.
Yes,
Amy.
Go ahead.
Well, the office of the national organization is 202-789-5600.
We'll give that number again at the end of the show.
Okay.
We're talking to Dr. Quentin Young, incoming president of the American Public Health Association. In fact, in a few minutes, he'll be giving his acceptance speech. He was elected last year, and each president for the APHA comes in a year later. The American Public Health Association, the world's oldest and largest organization of public health professionals, which represents 50,000 members from over 50 public health occupations.
And Dr. Young, I'd like to ask you, in terms of many cities in this whole reinvention of government of late have been trying to sell off whatever public health facilities they have. What's been the impact in cities that your organization may be have large numbers of members in terms of the delivery system or the network at the primary public health and prevention levels of these privatization attempts?
Well, this is uneven across the country, but the direction in general is very bad, as your question implies, and it's approaching crisis proportions in certain regions. This cutting back on budgets, on programs, which were in safety net and more, is occurring all over, and this is a fool's gold, because saving a few dollars now and undermining the public health infrastructure will come back to haunt us. We hear at this convention, which has people from literally every state, that they're under pressure everywhere, and a new element is privatization, as you put it. I was at a conference before this convention started last Wednesday in Indiana University, where we had a distinguished panel of HMO heads who tried to make the case that the HMOs have are brothers to the public health enterprise. They believe in prevention, they believe in population-based outcomes, and they do. And my response to that, it's a brotherhood. It's like Cain and Abel. that's a bitter joke, because they are destroying public health formations. And when they go under, and they are, incidentally, in this merry-go-round of huge capital shifts, you can look in the papers and see how these once hugely profitable HMOs, and many of them still are, but many of them are going under.
Like Oxford Health.
Exactly.
It just announced tremendous losses with the stock market going down.
Harbingers of what may come, and they're just wreaking havoc on our health system, which I'm sure, Amy, you know, I have been a critic of the old bad old days. It's certainly not an ideal system that they have replaced. But we must have a much better one in the post-corporate era. But having said that, what's happening now is destructive. It's ruining the institutional and workforce base of the healthcare delivery system. And people care about health. It's not a marginal thing. It's like food and shelter. It becomes an absolute necessity and affects everybody. This is the issue, I argue, that is cross-class, cross-gender, cross-race, cross-geography, and I think the American people are getting fed up. Their experience is cumulative, and every day, in fact, since we started this interview, a couple of thousand people have had a bitter experience trying to get care from their HMO or get care at all.
Of course, one that has been in the news a lot lately, Columbia Healthcare, if you listen to the federal government, that's practically an organized crime conspiracy or racketeering conspiracy there. But that's going to be decided in the courts. But I'd like to ask you
I want to comment on that.
Yes.
That's an extremely important point. Mostly we've been talking about excessive greed and distorting the system. But you're right. The criminal element seems to be appearing in these allegations and indictments that are coming forth. It's not a unique or aberrant thing. It's central to the likelihood of what we're going to be seeing more and more of. And that's precious billions of health dollars that have been misappropriated, according to the allegations.
But I'd like to ask you, what's been the impact on the average doctor of these changes in terms of their ability to provide the kind of health care that they went to school and learned to practice?
Serious. I'm a physician, as you indicated, practice, and I know what the mood is among American doctors, which is sullen and depressed. Some of this is a fall from grace. American doctors had become quite prideful and arrogant because everybody seemed to like their product and press their fees into their hands, and suddenly their world is turned upside down. And one of the manifestations of this, I think you'll be interested, is the call to action which emerged out of Massachusetts. Some 3,000 doctors and nurses have signed a call which calls for immediate moratorium on all for-profit conversions. You know what that means, where a Columbia HCA or similar entity comes in and buys a historic not-for-profit or even public institution mm-hmm. for a song and then proceeds to do what it wants to with it. That's happening all over the country, and this is what the call to action is pleading for, that moratorium. It calls for universal health care. It calls for ending of excessive corporate takeovers and corporate greed in the system. And that's moved out to some 15 other cities. In fact, it's going to be published in the December 3rd issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA. And it will reprint the signatures of some 3,000 doctors. I tell you these details to give you an idea that your answer to your question is a profound cataclysm within the House of Medicine.
Well, Dr. Young, I remember seeing you at the Democratic Convention standing outside in the protest pen that you had fought so hard to enlarge. But yes, there you were every day, because you are from Chicago,
yes,
there talking about the issue of single payer.
That's
and that
right.
The Democrats, which would have been the traditional reserve for supporters of single payer, were not addressing it within the convention.
Precisely. They had taken universal health care out of their platform for the first time since 1948. We call that the Dick Morris effect. The idiocy, a platform, after all, is just a puff piece. It's a wish list. And to take it out was execrable. And we had to go to federal court, you'll recall, Amy, to get the right to even pick at those guys.
That's right.
And it showed how low things had become. But, you know, there is a bottoming out, and there's a tomorrow. I have a certain amount of optimism that the American people will demand decent health care, and the American Public Health Association is committed to help it happen.
Well, you know, it seems that public health really runs antithetical to a for-profit organization, even like health maintenance organizations, because
yes,
you're talking about long-term preventative health.
Exactly.
And that's not what is maximized when you're talking about short-term gain, like the issue of immunization of children.
That's right. That's true. And while the HMOs tout the fact that it's to their advantage to do preventive measures, and to the short term it is, but you put your finger on it, they giving kids immunization is great. They'll keep them from getting whooping cough or diphtheria tomorrow. But what about the really serious illnesses, the chronic long-term illnesses? They have next to no interest. Those are costly items, you know, care every day or every week, and that's the kind of stuff they want to avoid. They are defining the priorities, and priorities, if you have if you're investor-owned, follow the profits, and that's contradictory to the goal of a decent health system, which is having the patient's interest primarily. And we're seeing that. I mean, that's not rhetoric. That's not a radical critique. That's what's happening. I think people within sound of my voice know it. I mean,
Dr. Young, we do have to go, but I want to thank you very much for joining us again. The new president of the American Public Health Association, the world's oldest and largest organization of public health professionals. The number to contact them in Washington, D.C., 202-789-5600. That's 202-789-5600. And if you'd like to get a copy of a cassette of Democracy Now! Today or any day, you can call the Pacific Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow we'll be speaking with Father Roy Bourgeois down at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning. There'll be major protests there this weekend leading to civil disobedience on Sunday. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, our director Leslie George, our engineers Errol Maitland and Andy York. Julie Drizin's our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!